Welcome to the Aging Scientist, focusing on all things science and aging. I'm Clarissa Giebel, and I'm a researcher at the University of Liverpool, exploring inequalities in dementia care and aging. Dementia features in the media more and more, which is good to see as it breaks down the long-held stigma and helps people to recognize symptoms earlier. The term media is quite broad, though, so in each episode of this new season, I will focus on a specific type of media. In this episode, we will focus on how dementia is captured in the literature. To discuss this with some literary and lived experts today, I'm joined by Professor Cindy Weinstein from the Caltech in the USA and Jeff Senaviratne, I hope I pronounced that correctly, former carer for his wife Teresa, who sadly passed away in early 2020. So, Professor Cindy Weinstein is the Eli and Edith Broad Professor of English at Caltech. She's the author of several monographs and edited volumes on American literature. In 2018 to 19, she was a Global Brain Health Institute Fellow at the University of California, San Francisco, where she studied neurology in order to write with Dr. Bruce Miller at UCSF, Finding the Right Words: The Story of Literature, Grief, and the Brain. Jeff is a retired clinical biochemist who had worked in laboratory medicine in the NHS. His wife, Teresa, was formally diagnosed with dementia in 2014 at the age of 66. In 2019, Jeff became a member of the Dementia Carers Expert Reference Group, working with Dementia United, the project set up within Greater Manchester to improve services and support for people living with dementia and their carers. So, great panel today. Thank you for joining us today. Welcome both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've got Cindy from across the big pond here today. It's 8 a.m. where she is right now, and it's afternoon for Jeff and I. Cindy, before we start discussing the broader topic of media, it'd be really interesting to hear about what the situation is like in the States surrounding dementia. What is care and what is support like? Is it focused more on medication or psychosocial, and can everyone access care?
It's hard to generalize, I think, and being an English professor, I'm especially cautious about making generalizations regarding fields that are outside of my area of expertise. But what I can say is that it's the situation is extremely heterogeneous, and I think very dependent on class and ethnicity and race, as so many things are. I think if you have money to help with care, that puts you in a completely different category than people who are shouldering their caregiver burdens on their own. And I think that that is not a specific thing to say about care in the US. I'm very active in a caregiving group, actually, in the UK called Diverse Alzheimer's. And many of the discussions that we have in that group about caregiving in the UK really resonate with what's happening in the US. I would also say, in terms of medication, that too is it's very difficult to generalize. And much of my experience with dementia is in the past. My father was diagnosed in the 80s and spent about a decade or so being ill with early onset Alzheimer's. And at that time, medication was sort of the go-to approach before you tried anything else. And I think the good news now is that different approaches are being tried, especially music and exercise and diet. And so, although medication, I think, is very frequently used, and I've read articles that suggest with COVID, it's been used even more in the last few years. There had been perhaps a bit of an abatement. For those who were willing to try new things, that seems to be a part of the discourse and part of the treatment in a way that it wasn't when my father was sick. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think that the true answer is that it's really all over the map. And the good news, though, is that I think physicians are less inclined to go with heavy-duty medication right off the bat. That seems to be more of a last resort. But I say that knowing full well that in many cases that's still not true.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'll come to you in a minute, Jeff. But just to pick up on you, Cindy, and so you just mentioned your dad had, was it young onset dementia? And he was diagnosed in the 80s.
Yeah. Well,
So.
in the 80s, everything was Alzheimer's. We didn't have the sort of careful, cartography of dementia that we have now. So it was only when I met Bruce Miller at UCSF that he gave me a precise diagnosis, even more precise than early onset. He said, based on everything I told him about my father, and there were no PETs or MRIs or anything like that, I tried to get them for Bruce, but couldn't. Bruce said that what my father had was early onset Alzheimer's with the logopenic variant.
Okay. And what has it been like to care? Well, have you cared for your dad, or was it your mum who was caring for your father? Or what have been your experiences like as a daughter then?
My mother was the primary caregiver, and during that time, it was in the US, we would call it the Wild West. Everybody was just on their own. Sort of support structures for carers were just not really a thing. And I write about this quite a bit in the book. I made an extraordinarily difficult decision to continue with my education and get my PhD when my father was ill. So the scene of the crime, as it were, happened in Florida, where my father spent most of his years being ill. And I was in California, specifically Berkeley, getting my PhD in English. And the guilt and regret and grief that went along with that decision to pursue my PhD, knowing that that's what my parents wanted, but also knowing just how impossible the situation was for my mother, was a source of great pain.
So, yeah, I am reading your book at the moment. I'm not finished yet. I've got it here right
Yeah.
next to me, finding the
Yeah.
right words.
So I went to Florida as frequently as I could, and I had thought perhaps about going to a graduate program on the East Coast to be closer. And my advisor gave me some very difficult advice that I ended up following, which was either go and take care of your father with your mother or finish the PhD here. You can't do both. So, yeah,
I'm
that was
sure that sounds really difficult, especially because you were of that pathway where we make those difficult choices in our life, isn't it? Do we do this? Do we do this?
right.
And then on top of that, the personal pressures. So,
Right. Yeah.
how does that resonate with you, Jeff? Now you've been caring for your wife, Teresa. What have been your experiences like? Does it differ much to what Cindy just said in terms of overall experiences?
Well, I guess there is a difference in terms. It was about 20 years later, and I was, we had been married a long time by that time. I guess some of your feelings, Cindy, may be ones that I haven't yet explored with my children about that. But I know that we had a lot of, I've got five children, and we had a lot of conversations around the time of diagnosis, and about, they were very concerned and helpful, and they were very helpful and supportive throughout all that, my time, and particularly when it came to making some difficult decisions around 2020, as my wife deteriorated very, seemed to deteriorate very rapidly in 2019, and the end of that year. And then we were then faced with this terrible disease that we didn't know anything about, that was going to strike us all down, and what was going to happen if I got ill with this, and, you know, so there were those things. And so I did get a lot of support from my family, from my children, and from other family members around that. But I think the other difference about the sort of diagnostic process is, in the UK, young onset is before the age of up to 65, and then it's not young onset. That might be the worldwide definition. My wife had been seen at the Memory Assessment Service in 2012, and because she knew she had some problems in there, but wasn't, there were sort of log jams in the system and long waiting lists for further investigation, but was essentially reassured. But, you know, with hindsight, you'd say she should have been at least been classified as mild cognitive impairment, I think, at that sort of time. But and we needed to sort of, I guess it was our initiative to re-enter the system and say, look, we didn't get this, I think we should go back to the assessment service. I think in the UK, I feel what, in terms of the treatment and support, I have this feeling that if it's Alzheimer's, where there is some medical treatment, and so there is a little bit of a system that you're in and being in some way monitored by, because you're taking the cholinesterase inhibitors that would are prescribed. If you get other forms of dementia, the rarer forms are often much harder to diagnose anyway, and it can be a long time going around the system to get a proper diagnosis. And vascular dementia is almost just ignored. Well, as far as I can say, after diagnosis, that's it. And you'll remember, Clarissa, the story that the other person on the panel, Chris, told about his diagnostic thing at the age of 47, and there was essentially no support. And I think that's one of the things that all forms of dementia, there needs to be something in place to support the person, to help them to continue to live well, and to provide the support that they need, and to people caring for them. And I think we've got, there's a long way to go in terms of providing that. I could say more about that, but maybe you want, you know, I know I don't want to say that, you know, I'll let you guide us, Clarissa, in terms of where you want us to go with this.
No, that's fine. It's to get an understanding, I think, for all of us in terms of both of your backgrounds and experiences. But yeah, I'm sure there's lots you and I, Jeff, could say about the UK system, isn't it, and what's kind of working and different experiences. But I want to take us, so that's, it's nice to hear as well about different experiences and different relationships. So you were caring for your wife, and your father was having dementia. So it's this roles as well. So let's have a little focus on your book, Cindy, that you've written. So it's called Finding the Right Words, The Story of Literature, Grief and the Brain. And you've co-written this with Bruce Miller, behavioral neurologist. So when I look through this, it's each chapter where you've written something, Cindy, and then it's almost like Bruce is saying something from a more scientific stance compared to your lift experiences. Is that right?
Right.
Do you
That's
want to tell
right.
us a bit more about the book?
Sure thing. Thank you. And Jeff, I just want to say I'm so sorry to hear about your wife and everything you've gone through, and just sending my empathy out there to you.
Thank you. Yeah.
So I wrote Finding the Right Words with Bruce Miller, and Bruce is a world famous neurologist, and his area of expertise is frontotemporal dementia, but he is an expert in all things dementia. And the structure of the book, since that's what you asked about, is it's kind of call and response between me and Bruce. And I talk about my father's disease in a series of chapters focusing on specific clinical presentations, beginning with a chapter on diagnosis. And like you, Jeff, we knew something was wrong with my father years before the actual diagnosis. My mother had brought him to a hearing doctor probably 2 decades before the diagnosis. And I tell the story in the book about how the hearing doctor told my mother there was nothing wrong with my father's hearing, and then, in a horrible misogynistic comment, asked my mother how long they had been married, and she told him, and the doctor said, "Well, he just doesn't want to listen to you anymore." And I told Bruce that story, and Bruce was like, "Okay, that goes in the book." And so the opening chapter is on diagnosis, and then I talk about my father's difficulty with word finding. And then there's another chapter about his spatial disorientation, and another chapter about sort of behavioral anomalies, which, when I first studied neurology that year at UCSF, I had no idea that dementia involved all of those things. I thought it was all about memory, which was wrong. And I thought the first chapter was going to be memory. That turned out to be the final chapter. And so the last chapter, as I said, is about memory. And it's about Bruce describing the different kinds of memory that we have. And in the course of writing that chapter, I, in a well, ironic twist, kind of recovered memories of my father, my healthy father, because I had kind of lost all those, or I hadn't lost them, but I hid them away so deeply because it was so hard for me to remember my healthy father. So that's the structure of the book, the chapters. And each chapter is me reflecting on aspects of my father's illness from the point of view of a daughter who just adored my father, and also my love of literature, and how being a reader and loving plots and characters and narratives kind of gave me a very strange framework both to hide from what was happening to my father, and also in the margins of my own brain, process what was happening to my father. And then, in response to those discussions of my dad, Bruce then reflects from a more neurological perspective what was happening in my dad's brain. The idea being that it was really important for me not to tell this story as a typical memoir, because I knew that there were a lot of people who didn't have access to Bruce Miller or to UCSF or to the Penn Memory Center or to the Mayo Clinic. And I wanted readers to get sort of the best scientific information they could in my book. So the really wonderful thing that happened, I think, in the course of writing the book is that the two disciplines, me being a humanities professor, Bruce being a scientist, eventually merge. And Bruce becomes not just the neurologist weighing in an objective data-oriented way about the disease, but then reflects on his own career as a neurologist and what about the brain drew him to studying the brain and talking about what motivates him as a doctor and the importance of storytelling and how important reading was in his life.
Thank you. So with your dad having been diagnosed in the 80s, and you said you were writing this, is it 2018, 29, together with Bruce?
Yeah.
What made you decide after this time had passed to then think, I want to write a book, but I want to write this type of book?
I knew that I wanted to write a book about my dad. I wanted to honor my dad. That was obvious to me for many, many years, and it took me a long time both to find the time as a professor to write the book, and happily I was coming up with other ideas about American literature, and so I was, you know, sort of working on more academic books. But there was always a part of me that wanted to write this other book. And it took me a really long time to find someone to write it with. I initially worked with someone who had a writing block, and so that didn't work very well. And then I thought maybe I would work with someone at Caltech, but we really don't do very much research on Alzheimer's and dementia at Caltech. We're starting to do some work on Parkinson's, but there really wasn't an obvious person at Caltech to write a book with. And so I spoke with colleagues at Caltech, and one thing led to another, and I ended up in 2017 in Bruce's office. He responded to one of my emails and we really hit it off. And he said to me, do you want to learn some science? And those were magical words. And I said, yeah. And he said, we have this amazing interdisciplinary program called the Global Brain Health Institute. There's a site at UCSF, there's one at Trinity College Dublin. He said, why don't you apply to it and see if you get in? And I got in, and what I needed to do was learn enough neurology to be able to kind of set the table for him in my chapters so that he could then write the sections that he needed to write.
It's a really nice connection there, isn't it? From your English literature background, from your lived experience background, and then with the science meeting that all together. I've got a question for you both, building on what you were saying, and you've written your book, Cindy. In this episode, we look at books and literature on dementia in the media, but either before you were a carer or since, have either of you come across dementia in the media, and in what platform?
Shall I start?
Yeah, start off.
So before, I think I knew very little about dementia. I mean, I knew Alzheimer's was a disease, and that, I mean, I knew from my background and you know, from my work, that there were certain genes that were associated with it, and other gene testing needed to, you know, the whole ethical issue about accidentally finding that somebody's got a gene that predisposes to Alzheimer's and all of that, but it was like something that you don't want to get, you know. But nobody wants to get that diagnosis. It's more frightening than cancer diagnosis, and all those things that were there. But I learned fairly rapidly about dementia and that. But I think one of the things is that dementia is really quite unique to the individuals. There's not, you know, there's a saying that people have said to me several times, you've met one person with dementia and you've met one person with dementia, really. That is the thing. So in terms of the media, there were certain things, there were the films like Finding Alice that I thought, I'm not sure I want to watch this film, or maybe we don't want to watch it together, but I'll watch it on my own. That type of thing. I didn't want to watch it with my wife, and there's been other things, and particularly on on television in the UK, there were a number of programs made by people living with dementia so I think there's just whether it's coincidence or whether it's just my I'm more aware, but there seems to have been much more about dementia in the media than there used to be. And I don't know whether it's just because I'm more observant about it now.
No, I think I agree though. I think in the past, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years or something, there's certainly more in the UK media at least around dementia. You see it in Christmas adverts and TV adverts, there's lots of reality TV programs, all these things. So what is it like in the US, Cindy? Is it covered well?
I guess the way I was initially going to answer that question was less from a US perspective and just more sort of my own learning about dementia. And what I did in order to write the book with Bruce was I tried to read as much as I could of books about dementia, memoirs in particular, and that was sort of my kind of education in the genre of writing about dementia. And so there were like the classic books by Oliver Sacks that I found really helpful. Like I wanted to think about how the story, the individual stories of dementia had been told, and what I liked about some, what I thought needed to be improved with respect to others. There was this one memoir by this woman, Eleanor Fuchs, that I found really interesting. And what I liked about it was she didn't like her mother very much, and then her mother got dementia, and then her mother kind of metamorphosed and she kind of started falling in love with her mother again, so that was a really interesting take on it. This woman, Sue Miller, who's a writer, talks about her father's dementia. And I remember reading that book, and there was this moment where she starts talking about the science behind his dementia. And it was at that moment where I thought, I'm really glad I have a scientist who's going to be doing this, because I could kind of do what she did, but Bruce can really bring his expertise to it. And so my sort of, oh, and then there were some other books. I tried to read everything I could get my hands on. There was a book called Brain on Fire by, I'm not sure I'm going to get her first name right, by Cahalan. It was made into a Netflix movie. And so there, but then to answer your larger question about how it's covered in the US, that again, that's such a big question. I think that people are realizing that the stigma around this disease, and then sort of the gag order on being able to talk about it and represent it, that's lifting. And so one of the things I really find very powerful is spending time on Twitter, and I see people posting photographs of people with dementia, which I think is just so important, because you look at some of the assisted living photographs of people with dementia, and they just seem just sort of not right in some way. It's so sanitized. It's so, I don't know, unreal. And then you see people posting images of their loved ones with dementia. Sometimes they're happy images, sometimes they're really hard images. And I just think that's so important.
I think you pick up on a good point there, that when we speak media, it's not necessarily something that's well-structured, well-planned, like your book, really well-prepped, or a media campaign on TV or
right.
something. It can be each single individual with those lived experiences of dementia sharing their own stories on social media. And I come across so many carers and people living with dementia these days on Twitter, Facebook, all these platforms. And it's good to see that. It brings much more life to the story. And I see how active some of those carers are with their relatives with dementia, doing music and all sorts of things.
I mean, one of the things that I reflect, if I positively about that, is that my wife wasn't in denial. I mean, Teresa wasn't in denial about what she had, which I've heard other stories of people won't accept diagnosis. And she would even, you know, openly introduce people. You know, she'd meet friends and she would tell them with just like that, you know, out of the blue, which was quite, you know, she'd go, I'm going to tell the neighbours about this because I don't, you know. And that was helpful, but it also helped people to be supportive as well and to support me. But in those, I mean, at that point where, you know, there's a point where there's a diagnosis. Well, before then and immediately afterwards, the person's still the same. They're still behaving in the same way. They've just got a label on the way that they're behaving. And we continue to do a lot of things. I mean, you know, we have this mantra about living well with dementia, and I believe you have to do that, really, and to do as much as you can, and just adapt as things become more difficult. So we tried to be positive about it and to join positive initiatives, and were supported by organisations. And there was a group that was set up called, you know, Fabulous Forgetful Friends, that Teresa was a founder member of. And they, you know, they did fun things together and also advocated for people with dementia, which is important. Yeah.
The way you speak, Jeff, very much reminds me of Chris Mason, who's trying to live as positively with his young onset dementia and his wife, Jane, as they can. So they were on this show as well. And it's good to hear that. No, we live with it. We'll deal with it.
Yeah.
Good and bad days.
Yeah. And I mean, I must say, there were times, obviously, when Teresa got very upset about it. But then I remember once particularly, she said, I'm not upset for me. I'm upset for you. Because you're the one who's have to deal with it, you know. She had this awareness of where things were going, but it was her. But then, you know, that those were the things. So that, I think the other thing, I have just tried to read, I sort of looked up your book, and there's a few extracts on Amazon where I could just get a flavour of what it was about, Cindy, and it looked really interesting, actually. And those sort of things about, you know, learning about what this disease is, it's on my list now probably as well.
Oh,
so.
Thank you. Well, if I can just reflect on something you just said, Jeff, that's so powerful that your wife said that to you about sort of being worried about you. It makes me tear up a little bit, I have to say. And Bruce actually talks about how in certain people with dementia, sort of the empathy circuitry gets even stronger. You know, like that we have this sort of deficit model too often about dementia, but that there is a case to be made, a scientific case to be made, that as certain areas of the brain start, for lack of a better word, kind of turning off, others light up, and just sort of that expression of empathy that she gave you is just such a beautiful example of that.
And I think looking back through your book, Cindy, it's almost a stepping stone towards reading proper science books on dementia when you look at it in the visuals in Bruce's part of the chapter. So it's really nicely complementing one another. So that's really nice to see. So I've got a final question for both of you, and I'm really appreciative of both of you sharing your experiences here. But if you could design a media campaign or a piece of media to advertise for dementia, raise awareness, what form of media would you use? What would you do? Do you have any idea? I know, Cindy, you've written your book, which is fantastic. Is there anything else you would do? Or Jeff, do you have a great idea you would like to do?
I don't have a particularly great idea, but I would do take a sort of opportunity. I mean, before Teresa died, I actually got involved with Dementia United, and I'm pleased I did. It's providing opportunities to speak about dementia and to campaign for the improvement. So, I've taken part in some filming that they've done to promote the material that they're producing. And I think, I was persuaded, and I'm glad I did. I wrote a very short blog for the conference, which is, I think, there. But just, I mean, I think it. I really feel. I mean, there's a sort of like a suppressed anger about how this is so badly treated. It's a disease, and it's not treated the same way as most other diseases are, in terms of the people who are given these life-changing diagnoses, and in many cases just left to get on with things without any support and things. And I think that I don't quite know how I would put together a media campaign, but I just think we have to keep shouting about this as much as we can, because so much of the burden comes onto carers, whether it's spousal carers, and it's maybe more often women than men, I think, that are doing that role, but also the children of the people, I mean, so people caring for parents whose life is turned upside down, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to pick up on that before you, Cindy, I think the thing that's often forgotten as well is carers who have cared for someone. From all the people that I speak to, it seems like they're suddenly even more dropped into no one cares about them. Whilst they're a carer, they may get a tiny bit of support, but once they're not an active current carer anymore, there seems to be nothing. And I've also heard from people being moved out of peer support groups, although they've made friends there and peers. So certainly something to focus on, the care for carers. Cindy, what would be your campaign?
I guess throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. I think for some people, a book is a good campaign. I think for others, I have a colleague who did the program that I was in at UCSF. He is from Peru and he's a photographer, and he takes images of people aging in rural areas of Latin America. I think, for other people, the power of a photographic image could be really important. I know someone else who wrote a beautiful play called Unraveled, about frontotemporal dementia. The playwright is named Jake Broder. I think theater can be really powerful. There are doctors on social media who do Twitter threads about dementia. I think if you like your information digested in, small bullets, that could be really valuable. So, I think that the need is so great that whatever can be done, that's done carefully, thoughtfully, empathically, will be valuable.
I think that's a good point you raised, Cindy. There's so many different avenues one can make a campaign or shout out about dementia, what it's like to be a carer, what should be changed. It's not just one strategy, but it's loads of different ones. And all of us have different appetite for how we digest information. So it's good that there's these different avenues to do that. But I think that's all we've got time for. We've talked a lot about dementia in the media, and really great to talk to you, Cindy, about your book. I will finish this book very shortly. Great written, and I'll share the link to the book in the biography as well. So thank you both. So if you want to hear more about dementia in the media, including discussions with the UK Alzheimer's Society and with private eye cartoonist Tony Husband, tune into the next few episodes of this season. But for now, thank you both.
Thank you so much, Clarissa. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you very much.